Good morning, everyone. It's 8:30. Welcome to day 5 of the International Council on English Braille. Thank you. There's a lot of really good things about today, and one of them is this is the last time you're going to hear me read the health and safety briefing. Emergency evacuation. In the case of an emergency evacuation, an alarm will sound. Please follow the directions of our staff who will direct guests to the appropriate exits. There are 2 exits in Aucklander, one through entry point and one to the side behind the presenter's lectern. Please do not use lifts when evacuation is in process. Guests will be guided to the nearest assembly point, either at the forefront of the hotel, lobby car park, or the Vincent Street entrance. Restrooms and toilets. The nearest restrooms are located off the main lobby. As you are exiting Aucklander, turn right. Men's restrooms are located to the left, women's restrooms to the right. Smoking area. Smoking is prohibited inside the hotel. The allocated smoking area is located on our atrium lounge deck off level 1. First aid. If the circumstances arise that a guest requires first aid, please advise our staff for assistance. First aid kits are located in our lobby, reception, and each of our food and beverage outlets. Thank you. All right. Any Maria, do you have any announcements for this morning?
Please. Good morning. People want to know what the food choices are today.
Oh, yes.
Of course you do. So morning tea is obviously tea and coffee, and ginger slice, which is GF, DF, veg, and no nuts. The lunch is the main item is Reuben's sandwich with pastrami, smoked cheddar, sauerkraut, and Thousand Island dressing, GF, DF, V. The snack options are the Rick crackers and cheddar cheese, GF. And the sweet item is blueberry cheesecake, whole fresh fruit, bottled water and juice. The afternoon tea is tea and coffee, spinach and feta muffin, and it's vegan.
Well, I don't think we're going to be here for afternoon tea.
Don't worry, it won't go to waste.
Ah, good.
Take it home.
All right, thank you very much. Anything else? Yes, Amanda?
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Just, I have a list that Mary Schnackenberg has given me of people who are receiving, have to be at reception at certain times to leave for their flights. I have 11 people on this list, that is all. If you are not on this list, you are entirely responsible for getting yourself out there at whatever time you need to be out there to get to your flight. And if you miss your flight, I will not be held responsible. So, so I'm just going to read that list of 11 names, if that's okay. And I am really, I'm apologising in advance if I mispronounce anybody's names. So I have got Nancy and... How do I get... That's the one. Both have to be out at 10 past 10. I then have... actually, I'm going to read these in the order that they're on here, and it's not the time order, okay? So then I've got James Bowden, who has to go at 3, Jodie Doolin at noon, Francis Mary and Stephen, who have to go at 2:30, Christo at 3:30, Bill Jolly at 11:30, Ivan at 4:45, and Jen and Daphne at 4:15. So if you're not on that list, Ivan, yes.
Yeah, I'm leaving for tomorrow.
Okay. Okay, I won't kick you out then. And Christo's tomorrow too. I won't kick you out either. Okay, so that is the list that I have been given. If I need to make any other changes other than Christo and Ivan, can you let me know?
Yeah, I also know is Meg
I would like to know also, we have to be here, or we can be in another place here in the city, or in the house. I have to go close to the airport, so I don't know if it would be arrangeable to be closer to the airport.
The other part of this announcement is that if you have bags, if you could take them, like suitcase bags that you're keeping in this room, if you could take them down to the bar area and put them under the bench that has the tea and coffee on it, that will keep them neatly out of people's way until that fills up, at which point we will put them against the wall near where we had the demonstration tables yesterday. And are there any questions?
All right, thank you. Anything else? Okay. Jennifer. Wow. Jennifer Dunham's going to talk about one of my favorite topics. I think we don't talk about rail riding enough. So this is great. Hello. To your left. To the left. Left, left. Back this way.
Oh, gosh, thank you. You talked to
the... Oh, sorry. Okay. To the right.
There we go.
There you go. Okay.
Good morning, all. We, this morning, line up my microphone here. We're going to do a flyover tour of two centuries of evolution of Braille writing. Before we begin that, I want to talk a little bit about terminology. First is the term Braille readers. We all use it. I use it. Braille readers, we know what we mean. But it's been an experience from time to time that it can cause an idea of we are the people for whom Braille is prepared. Other people make the Braille, give it to us, we read it. We have alluded many times during this session to the fact that that is not the way it works. We all know that. The preparation of reading materials is vitally important, but the active use of Braille by individuals for record keeping and external communication brings its own set of issues that need attention as we move forward in education and other spheres, particularly as we are in the age of digital communication. To view Braille writing through a lens of its own can help us understand and address today's Braille writing possibilities and barriers. This morning we're going to talk about how the tools, functionality, and communication reach of Braille writing by blind individuals have evolved over the past two centuries. We will do, like I said, a flyover tour, and then we'll focus in on some of the current challenges and issues, including differences in Braille-centric versus print-centric digital writing environments, discrepancies in electronic translation from Braille to print, individual access to Braille embosser equipment, and more. But first, we have to talk about what does it mean to write Braille? That used to be a very simple thing, that question. It was to write using either six keys plus backspace and return key and a space, or using a slate and stylus so that the writing can be read back by touch in Braille dots. Methods of writing in general have changed, ideas of what constitutes writing Braille are also expanding. But what are the boundaries? It still seems almost miraculous that now someone who knows nothing about Braille can send a communication to be read instantaneously by someone who reads Braille. A Braille user with a mobile device can capture an image of written notes, even handwritten notes, and have it processed and presented in Braille. Nevertheless, the digital reproduction of an image and communication from a non-Braille user fall outside of what we're going to discuss here this morning. Instead, we're going to focus on writing that is generated from a person who uses non-visual techniques to access the writing. As we'll explore, Electronic communications make the method of writing less tied to the format of its results. And so there are reasons to focus separately on each of these aspects of writing. For this discussion, I'm going to talk about two different types of writing, two of them that fit. First, writing that is done with Braille keys, a slate and stylus, or a virtual keyboard, and or, two, writing that results in Braille that can be read by touch. From the perspective of the user experience, tools used for writing Braille differ in their portability, their cost, maximum achievable writing speed, surface of Braille display available at once, labeling capacity, ease of editing, ability to make the result match the intent, ability to tell whether the result matches the intent, the ease of communicating with non-Braille users, and others. And we're going to come back to that list at the end, but we'll be looking at those as we go. Beginning with the pocket frame that Louis Braille created by modifying Charles Barbier's writing board, through the interconnected refreshable Braille devices used for communication with anyone and everyone, the tools for writing Braille have both persisted and evolved. Each innovation has brought with it certain advantages, but none in itself has provided all of the equivalents needed to replace functions of the older tools. So the manual, the mechanical, and the digital all coexist as essentials in a Braille user's toolbox. As the electronic Braille writing devices continue to advance, so must our understanding of both their power and their limitations. We'll start out with the slate and stylus, which a lot of this is going to be very familiar ground to the folks here, no doubt. The method using the slate and stylus, it still, no matter, as you look at all the tools, this one remains the most portable and economical of all the tools. With no electronics or batteries to fail and no intervening translation software, the slate and stylus is a basic direct medium between the human brain and the page. The dots punched by the person are the dots that appear on the paper, perfection and mistakes alike. Perceptions of the right to left writing as backward are generally more of a deterrent to use the slate and stylus than any inherent drawback of the slate itself. It's the perceptions, not the actual. We have fluent slate users can write at speeds equivalent to that of a pen or pencil, and use of an abbreviated code like grade 3 Braille can enhance speed even more. Many use the slate and stylus for extensive note-taking or even to work mathematics. Some still do that today in regions where the slate is still preeminent. Cardstock paper makes for writing that is more durable. Thinner paper can be used to make writing easier and quieter. The slate must be removed from the lines that it covers during writing in order to read these lines, but aside from that, the size of the page determines how much Braille is accessible to be read back at any one time. Early slates included a board to which the paper was attached with holes on the sides to move the frame down for each new set of lines. The slate with pins directly on the frame for stabilizing the paper provided an even more portable option and became the standard in many places. Although a four-line slate that fits across the width of a page can be used with many paper sizes, slates have been manufactured in a wide variety of sizes and configurations to meet the needs. Capable of creating Braille labels on physical objects or being tucked in with an advanced electronic device for backup in case of an emergency, the slate and stylus remains unmatched in versatility for personal Braille writing. For much of its history, the only way to extend the reach of communication written on a slate beyond other Braille readers involved reading the writing aloud to be copied by a sighted scribe. The blind writer could also make a copy of the writing using a typewriter. Neither of these methods allowed the writer to confirm directly that a faithful copy has been made. Moving on to the mechanical Braille writer, the advent of these at the turn of the 20th century and their significant refinement in 1951 brought about options for writing and editing Braille with greater efficiency. The writing is done from left to right on the front of the paper, which can be less off-putting to some than is the slate method. Writing can be done as rapidly as on a typewriter, and the writing can be read immediately after it's written without the need to remove the paper from the device. Editing can be accomplished quickly by rolling the paper to the desired line and moving the carriage to the desired cell. As with the slate and stylus, deletions are made by erasing dots with a fingernail or braille eraser, or by writing full cells over the area to be corrected, or any other method that people devise. The ease of moving braille paper brought increased efficiency to working mathematics and to the writing of spatial material. As with the slate, dots from a mechanical braille writer appear exactly as typed by the writer, and the size of the page defines the display area. Less portable and at higher price than the slate and stylus, the mechanical braille writer's rugged construction and easy operation have nevertheless kept it in wide use today. Copying the writing on a print typewriter or dictating it to a human scribe remains for decades the primary ways to share the written work with those who do not read Braille. In mainstream education settings, a teacher of blind students or paraprofessional who knows Braille can handwrite the student's work directly on the paper for submission to the classroom teacher. Even with the electronic options of today, this method, known as interlining, provides the advantage of allowing the student to work in a Braille-centric way, especially when writing mathematics or spatial material. In the mid-1980s, an accessory for the Perkins Brailler called the Braille imprint, I think Jonathan Mosen alluded to this earlier this week, became an early effort to allow those writing Braille on paper to share their work directly with non-Braille users. The standard Brailler was placed on top of a metal box with spring-loaded keys that activated with the press of a Brailler's keys. When the user pressed the line advance key, the device translated into print the line that had just been brailled, then printed the line on a connected daisy wheel printer. The braille imprint had no way to synchronize with any edits made on the braille page, and there was no way for the writer to verify directly the accuracy of the translation and printout. The noisy line-by-line printout printing also made the approach impractical in classroom settings, but the effort helped to clarify some of the challenges to be addressed. Moving into six keys, no dots. The coming of the Braille and Speak in 1987 sparked praise and controversy. The six-key device, with its internal storage, small size, and extra functions like a clock and calculator, offered portability closer to that of a slate and stylus, along with Braille writing speed more like that achievable on a mechanical writer, with a little less noise. Unless connected to a Braille embosser, however, which was for a long time an option unavailable to many and inconvenient besides, its only non-visually accessible output was a translation from Braille to synthetic speech. It could export the writing to a printer, but it had no non-visual way to be certain that the translation was correct. Nevertheless, the device remained wildly popular for many years because of its functionality. In theory, it seemed ideal to help blind students in mainstream settings needing to communicate their work to their teachers and to take their own notes. Unfortunately, the Braille and Speak and other similar devices were sometimes deployed in educational settings without a clear understanding that they did not address the reading half of the literacy equation for students. Decades later, now, mainstream mobile devices with quantum leaps forward in functionality are now essential in the lives of many and can be accessed with a screen reader through speech and or Braille. For many, the best non-visual method of writing on a touchscreen is through Braille screen input. It involves calibrating six fingers on the screen and then tapping them in the same configurations used with Braille keys. Gestures are available for deleting by character or word. The devices can be oriented vertically with the screen facing away from the writer so that the writer can do it while standing up or otherwise not at a table. Writing on screen can generally be accomplished more quickly than through using the on-screen keyboard, the QWERTY keyboard. Although no tactile dots are involved, Braille screen input is an essential tool for writing on a mobile device when it's inconvenient or impossible to connect an external communication device. Its utility relies on accuracy of Braille to print translation. Now, Six Keys Refreshable Braille. The Braille X was the first refreshable Braille device designed by Pappenmeyer Company in Germany and was released to the public in 1975. Anyone seen those? I have not. The Braille X and other similar early devices like the VersaBraille, which was more common, did not involve translation to or from print, at least at first, but they stored and retrieved Braille data using cassettes with a limited editing capability. They displayed one line of Braille at a time via electromechanical cells with pins that raised and lowered in different combinations of formation to be type, information to be typed or read. Although considered portable by the standards of the day, they were quite fragile and could not be used on the go. Over time, refreshable Braille devices came more affordable and portable with internal storage, and they began to include print, translation, and options for connectivity. Most refreshable Braille devices now include synthesized speech output, which can be disabled as a person may wish to do so. A one-line display is still commonplace, although line lengths vary. A variety of navigation keys, shortcuts are typically available for faster movement through books or documents. Two distinct environments for writing Braille are available in most standalone devices. In this discussion, we're going to refer to them as the Braille-centric and the print-centric environment. Helpfully now, some of the newer refreshable Braille devices have implemented two separate document editors within their own suite of internal applications, one specifically designed for each of the two environments. If the writer knows that the document will be needed in a non-Braille format, the appropriate editor can be chosen so that no export is needed. So talking about the Braille-centric environment, the person writing interacts with a Braille format file and typing is done without translation of any kind. Similar to Brailing on paper, as typing occurs, the dots present exactly the dot configurations that have been typed, errors and all. If the document is for personal use, the writer can do math problems, underline words, using typeform indicators, make up symbols of shorthand if they want, use grade 3, anything. It's all fair game. Many of these devices have powerful editing capability in this format, allowing for blocks of text to be moved and deleted. A search can be done on any dot configuration. If a print-based version of the document is ultimately required, then once the typing and editing are complete, it can be translated to print and exported to a print-based format for sharing with others. On some devices, you can even copy from to a clipboard and send it to an external device via Bluetooth. So in the print-centric Braille environment, the user also types with six keys, can type with six keys, but the destination of the typing is either a print-based file format like TXT or DOCX, or the interface with an application or a device. So typing into a search bar on a browser, or a text message, or a Google Doc, all of those are examples of the print-centric Braille environment. The environment is in effect by default when screen readers or devices interact with print-based applications. As the writer types with six keys, two things happen in quick succession. First, the typed text is translated from Braille to print and written to the destination. Then, to display for the user what has been written, the material is translated back to Braille. If both the typing and the translation systems are accurate, the dots displayed will generally be the same as the dots typed. In other words, the user experience is very similar in the print-centric and the Braille-centric environment. But in the case of general typing errors or Braille rule violations by the user, or of inaccuracy in the translation software, the Braille displayed back will differ from what is typed. If the user forgets to use a contraction, then in the round trip translation, the contraction will display back in the word displayed on the braille. However, if the user uses a contraction in a manner that's against the rules, an accurately functioning system will translate the typing to print according to braille rules, then present a braille translation of that result. So the user is immediately notified. You can see it's very different from what you typed, so there must have been some type of mistake there, so you can go back and check and fix. An example of how things got simpler, but as the power increased, so does the complexity. On some of the more feature-rich devices, structured mathematics can be written out accurately in this environment with internal applications. The user toggles into a mathematics mode via a specified keystroke to write out the expression using the math code. And I want to emphasize that in these devices, the switch is necessary regardless of whether you're using UEB for math or whether a different code is being used for math. To get into the structured mode, you have to hit a toggle or a switch key. But once that mathematics is typed in, it can be exported to a format readable by a print user. A six-key device connected to an external device, like a phone, is also operating in a print-centric environment. The connected braille display is driven by the screen reader to an external device, including whichever translation program is in effect in conjunction with the screen reader. The connection is also another factor that can influence or affect the writing experience if there's a lag or an unexpected disconnection. QWERTY is another way to write Braille. The devices that have a PC that has a QWERTY or a Mac or a phone with a QWERTY keyboard, they can be used to display Braille back from the material that's typed in. Some writers actually can use both types of keyboards with equal agility and use either one at different times. Braille devices with built-in QWERTY are usually a little larger in size than the six-key devices. When the writer works on a QWERTY desktop or laptop computer with the synthesized speech, proofreading and editing are made more efficient by a connected Braille display with its handy cursor routing buttons for quickly placing the cursor at a specific spot. Since typing on a QWERTY keyboard is naturally print-centric, there's only two steps. You get the translation from print to Braille so that you can, as a writer, verify what has been written. I have a section in here about dictation, because dictation is one way that people write down things a lot, and using a Braille device is an excellent way to make sure to catch those errors that occur in dictation, unfortunately, far more abundantly than any of us would like to see, but editing them in Braille makes it go much faster. Skipping through there. I have a little section in here about Braille embossers as a tool for Braille writing. It probably should have been fleshed out a bit more, because we talk here about the use of a computer you can type your work in, or into a device you can type your work in and then have it embossed onto Braille paper. But it's important to notice, that there are three specific pieces of software and hardware needed for this method. You need your computer device, you need your embosser, and usually need a translation software package, which often comes at a high price tag. Got some good options now that don't, but it's a lot of cumbersome between the writing and the getting it onto paper. So zooming in on the digital writing with its possible, with its problems and its possibilities. So as we have been talking about this week, Unified English Braille was carefully developed to ensure that both print to Braille and Braille to print electronic translation could be accurately supported. UEB has removed the ambiguities and conflicts that particularly frustrate reliable translation from Braille to print. Programmers from commercial companies with open source projects like LibLU, we have made enormous progress toward fully realizing the potential brought about by the adoption of UEB. I've given a couple other papers before this body, and I'm so delighted to tell you that many of them are out of date now, and I love that. Couldn't be happier, because those errors have been fixed. There does remain some room for improvement to get to the level of reliability that is needed by those who write Braille, to use it confidently for learners and people who are developing writing fluency. So, as we've seen, translation plays an important role in allowing the writer to read back what has been written in a print-centric environment. A lot of strides have been made, but a couple of things. We talked a little bit earlier this week about the fact that if you have a method of writing or including your type forms, italics, underlining in your writing, whether that is by Braille indicators or by special keystrokes, it won't display back on most devices when writing in Braille. Since it's a free screen reader, I'll point out that NVDA screen reader will display those type forms back, but other screen readers either will not display them or do it only in very limited circumstances. And that affects one's ability to assess the writing. There are also issues around translation, back translation. Mathematics and type forms are also issues here on back translation. We've been talking some this week about the importance of Braille rules and the basis of Braille rules for translation from print to print and from print. We have an opportunity for those of us who use an iPhone, and I'll just distill this down what I've written here. It's possible to do a very quick side-by-side comparison of the system. The system mode in the iPhone versus the other one, and there are differences between them. One of them is not able to contextualize some things. Like, for example, the issue of writing a web address, http://. The colon is .25, and without going too much in the weeds of the rules, because it is between a letter and a non-alphabetic symbol, it's not a CC and it's not a colon. Or I'm sorry, it's not a CC and it's not a con sign, but it's a colon. One of the systems that is commonly used in screen readers is not able to translate that yet. And I point that out not to bash anybody or be critical of anything, but it's important for folks who are deploying these systems out there in the world for students in educational settings and work settings to understand that there is still some work to be done, and to call on folks that are much smarter than I am with the solutions. I'm a person, I like to bring solutions, but I don't know how to fix it, and I hope there's someone who knows how to fix these type of things out there. A similar issue is about numeric mode. It's not able to do the translation in such a way. For example, okay, let me just talk about the example that I've used here. The it's not a word, I guess, but sixth, like on the sixth floor. If you type, if you're typing six keys, you should type a numeric indicator, a six, a T, and an H, because there are no contractions in numeric mode. In the example with the iPhone, the translation software basically is allowing the use of the contraction and translating it back for you properly. So you might just think, oh, this is a nice autocorrect because I, you know, did it wrong. But it really conceals a larger problem that the mode is not being able to be invoked on this. These are two examples of a larger issue. The list of issues, as I've said to someone earlier, the list of these type of issues is short, but their impact is broad. So it's something that I hope that we all can encourage, get some attention, and be corrected. Because as we look at our tools for writing, this is just one of the barriers that prevents them from having their full power. Earlier, I was talking about a list of criteria. There was going to be an appendix to this paper, but I hemmed and hawed around and could never become happy with it. But it basically looked at all the tools that I've just talked about, and it measured them, it compared them, I'll say, in terms of their portability, cost, maximum achievable writing speed, surface area of Braille available at once, their ease of the process from beginning to end. Can they label physical objects? Can the writing be read tactually? The ease of editing. Can Braille be used to make sure that the content matches what is intended? Ease of communication with others. So the total possible score, I did, in this comparison, there were three total points possible. The total possible score was 33. In my little system that I used, that is no way scientific, but you know, it had some interest. The highest score I achieved was 27 for any of them. Does anyone have an idea which one might have been the 27? Guesses? Between the mechanical brailler, slate and stylus, Braille and Speak type device, or the standalone note taker, or a connected Braille display. According to my little system, my Jennifer Dunham little system that is nobody else's, but according to mine, the highest achievement was the Braille writer. The second highest was the slate and stylus. And you know, I was a little surprised by that because we do have, as you heard, there are criteria in there about ability to communicate with others, editing and all of that such. As we look at some of these others, though, the standalone note taker and the screen reader with the Braille device ranked very close to the slate and stylus. And if we can get some of the back translation issues improved, they would have the same score as well. So that is my discussion for today. Thank you all very much, and I look forward to continuing. Happy to take questions or discussion if anyone has any.
Golden.
Just waiting for the four. Oh, there we go. Thank you, Jennifer. I loved the overview and the rating system that you had. I just wanted to comment. I was a child who resisted the slate and stylus because I had learned to use a brailler, and so in my mind it was like a step backwards. And then on my the night before my first day of high school, I thought, and this is you're gonna know what kind of teenager I was. I'm gonna look kind of geeky walking around with a brailler. I think I should use my slate and stylus because I can just carry it with all my books. It'll be easier. And I used a slate and stylus to take notes all the way through high school and university. And I don't regret it for a minute. I just wish I hadn't been so stubborn as a child. I bring that up not just because, you know, I want to tell you how shallow I was when I was 14, but I'm glad that you talked about the slate and stylus because I feel like there's a lot of, it's not getting its due. Like there are, you know, people who aren't being taught it. There are people who kind of think it's outlived its time. But in my mind, there's really no replacement. As much as I'm, you know, I have all my gadgets and I love them. I think that we need to not lose sight of the slate and stylus. And my TVI would be very happy to hear that.
Thanks, Jen.
My experience
was very similar. I was actually told, well, you can't learn to use a slate until you're 10 because they really confuse your Braille, which was very unfortunate. As I was getting ready to do this paper, I was talking to people, and they talked to me about some folks who were in their, you know, came up in the 50s and 60s, and they talked about, well, I did math on a slate, it was no problem. When I was in kindergarten, you know, they had little kindergarten-sized hands, and they would use their chin on their stylus because they're working on their hand strength to help them punch the dots. But they did it, you know? It was a way to get it done, and it's still such an important, it's just such an important point. All of the tools are still needed.
How? 1x6?
Great.
Well, I'm very excited to say that I got a shipping notification this morning saying that a Versa slate is on its way to my house, which I'm very, very excited about. I wondered about whether you'd heard about the Slimline, which was a device between the Braille to print and anything more techie. I don't know whether it was just available in Australia, but it was kind of like the Braille to print, but obviously it was slimmer, and it fitted on the bottom of your Perkins Brailler. It had four memory banks, and you could choose whether to write in, I think it was English, Italian, German, and French. You could write in four different languages with little prefixes. And that way you could carry your Perkins around to, it was something I used in high school, you could carry your Perkins around to different classrooms and then come back at the end of the day and print stuff out for your teachers if you wanted. So I just thought about that device as something else that was around in the 80s and to mid 90s sort of thing.
Interesting. Did it connect to a printer?
Yes.
Okay.
I can't remember what sort of printer, but similar to the Braille to print, I think.
Gotcha. I was quite certain that I would have omitted things that were popular elsewhere, and that I'm glad to learn about these ones.
But I do remember the Braille to print. Very early on.
Hiya. Sorry, I'm not sure if I jumped the queue, sorry. I just wanted to mention about back translation, and thank you for bringing up the points that you brought up. I'm sure that James Bowden will be able to talk much more eloquently on this subject, but when you're writing Braille tables, forward translation and back translation are almost their own problem in a lot of ways, and I think certainly if I was writing a Braille table and I looked at something like number sign 6, TH sign, and I saw that back translated just, you know, the back translated in the way that it did, I don't think I'd perceive it as a particularly big deal to fix because, well, fine. But number sign 6, TH back translates properly. So what does it matter that number sign 6, TH sign also back translates properly? You know, it just wouldn't seem to be an issue. So therefore, not much attention would have been given to it because it wouldn't have been seen as a terribly big priority, and it would have actually involved quite a lot of extra work. So it's good to know the reasons why it should be made a priority. And I can't promise that anything will be done about it, but it's good to know. It's good to know them, because the more that you can articulate a use case for something, the more likely it is that, you know, development time will be put towards it.
Thank you. Yes, and 2 points about that. Number one is that I don't think I said it, but in the paper I point out this is a road. I think it's one of the roadblocks to getting mathematics implemented in a more streamlined way. And number two, for that, just from the user perspective, and again, I wish I knew how to fix it, but the fact that I'm able to, on an iPhone, toggle between the tables and have it back translate correctly with one and not with the other says there's a way to fix this. There's got to be a way. So, thank you.
I'm from Spain. I'd like to share my experience that I just bought a Korean slate and stylus, which you write like four lines and with stylus, and it pops out the dots, and it's plasticky and lovely and light, and it's a new one, and I love this kind of old-ish trying to remember all these lovely devices. And also, if anyone was interested, I am creating a program that allows translation pattern to pattern. So, for example, if someone needed to get technical material or there was any issue, and for example, I have Spanish Braille music papers, we can translate it into English one, no matter exactly what the signs mean, but rather what the patterns are. So, in case. Unless until the Unicode patterns are universally used, it could be useful. This kind of thing. In case anybody was interested, when I'm finished with the program, it's going to be called BrailleCore. In case someone wanted or was useful. Sorry.
It's called what?
BrailleCore. That's my method that I. BrailleCore. C-O-R in one word. So in case anybody wanted that software. And currently it's going to be working in Python, in iPhone, but I expect to extend it for other devices. Thank you.
Mike 1.
Oh, here we go. Kia ora. Thanks for that. You really took me back in lots of ways. Interesting to hear some of your comments on the Braille and Speak. I got a Braille and Speak when I started university and just thought it was the most amazing thing ever. I mean, classmates used to ask me for my lecture notes because I could type at, you know, pretty much verbatim. And this is late 80s, so I was the only one with a kind of computer around. So, you know, or the nearest to it, so I think that's cool. One of the things I wanted to mention, and it's a bit difficult because I've forgotten its name, but there is a slate in the UK now that allows you to write forward. And I think that's pretty cool. King, is that right? Okay. It takes a bit of getting used to. I really struggle with a slate because I was taught on a Perkins and then having to reverse it, I kind of struggle with. Interestingly, my partner, who's sighted and writes much quicker than I do with a slate and stylus, because she's not quite got the memory on learning stuff. So, but I think it's great to have a discussion on the topic of Braille writing, because I think it's missed out an awful lot. We concentrate on reading. And just to finish, I was given a style and it sounds like I was taught on a Perkins, given a style and slate when we went on a school trip from Edinburgh to Holland when I was about 13, because our teacher said it was the only portable thing. But the thing that impressed me most was that she gave the whole class their stylus in a cork. So we thought she must be drinking an awful lot of wine.
Thank you.
Here we kept those down in the corner.
Mountain? How much more time you want to? Okay.
It's on Roman one.
Bowden?
I have a question about 6 TH sign, reverse translate. What should it do?
It's an excellent point. I skipped over this in the paper, but what it does in the system...
I know what it does, but what it do?
That is a great question. A question mark is not the right thing, I don't think. I would think perhaps just ignore the 1, 4, 5, 6.
Mm. Okay.
Right.
Thank you.
Golden? All right, one more.
All right, Golden.
I just wanted to ask, has anybody here, because there's people from Australia, and has anyone used the Jot-a-Dot? I only ask because, oh my goodness, okay. I only ask because I used to see it when I was, you know, you go over, okay, maybe just me, you go randomly searching online for different Braille things, and it always came up, but it was always this thing that people had in Australia, and it seemed like a kind of cool device, but never actually saw one. It never worked? Okay.
Braille was all soft. But the Braille's a bit soft.
Okay. Yeah. I was always just curious about it. It seemed like kind of a fun device.
All right. Well, thank you very much, everyone.
Was really interesting. Thank you, Jennifer. I won't do it. Okay. Matthew.
I'm coming around.
Good morning once again. Who'd have thought 3 days out of 5 that I'd be standing at the lectern? Okay, so some time ago the call for abstracts came out for papers, and I thought, no, I'm never going to write a paper. I'm not really the type of person to write a paper. And then somebody told me that I ought to write one, and so I thought, yeah, all right, fine, I'll write one. I called it Multi-Line Braille Displays, So What? Hoping to sort of stimulate some discussion on the title alone, really. Considering the practical use and ongoing development of multi-line Braille displays from a user perspective. I say a user perspective, I really do mean a user perspective. I'm about to present some comments. I believe those comments. I wrote them. I stand by them. I'm a user, and that is all I am in this context. I mean, I train people to use computers, and that includes training them how to use Braille displays. I work a lot with Braille users other than myself, you know, through works, you know, with the Braille Authority and one thing or another. But really, I mean, I'm just here to present it as I see it. I haven't done any sort of advanced research into this. But, you know, people seem to think that my opinion's interesting. So here we are. Really, the basis of what I'm going to say is that so far, we've talked about multi-line Braille displays. And when we've talked about multi-line Braille displays, we've said, well, of course they're better than single-line displays. And when people have said, well, why are they better than single-line displays? Well, because they're multi-line, it's obvious, right? They've got more than one line. And I just don't really think that stacks up. I think multi-line Braille displays can be very useful. I'm certainly not anti-multi-line Braille displays. I think they have a place, but I think their place needs to be more than just being multi-line for the sake of being multi-line. And that's really what I'm hoping to unpack in the next little while. So some of the questions that we need to be asking, or that I think we ought to be asking, are manufacturers trying to solve the right problem? Well, if you're trying to just add extra lines without really understanding what those extra lines are, perhaps not. Are multi-line Braille displays always the best solution? How can multi-line Braille displays evolve to meet more user needs more effectively? And what other developments are required to ensure that multi-line Braille displays reach their full potential? And to start that discussion, we're going to talk about the limitations of single-line displays and workarounds for and solutions for how we overcome them. I think probably when we talk about multi-line Braille displays, the first thing that people say is either mathematics or spreadsheets, you know, tables, that sort of thing. Displaying tables on a single-line Braille display is tricky because you've only got one line. So at best, you can only show one row at a time. If you're showing one row at a time and you've got short data in one row and long data in another row, so that the rows, you know, so the short data has lots of space after it to accommodate the long data in the row below, that's not obvious on a single line display because you can't see the row below. So there's this, you're showing one row at a time, so you've got no context of the row above or the row below, and you're looking at all of this empty space on the display going, why is this empty space there? We can wrap content on a Braille display. We can wrap it at the word level, but we can't wrap it at the cell level. So also you have no context of, let's say you have a table that's 30 cells across and your display is only 20 cells across. When it wraps at cell 20, we don't know whether that's wrapping at a cell boundary or not. So we don't know when we pan forwards, we don't know whether the content that we're encountering is from the same cell that we were at before or whether it's at the next cell. So, you know, there are ways of fixing this problem. You can pan up and down. You could move line by line instead of display length by display length, and you could sort it out that way. That's a bit clunky, but you could do it. You could also adjust it so that you're only showing one cell at a time rather than showing one row at a time. This is, I think, how most screen readers, in my experience, tend to do it, at least by default. You see a line, and in the, if there's any space left on the Braille display, you see the coordinates. You see R1, C1, and you might even see the headers if you have a particularly long Braille display, and that's how you get around it. If you are able to visualize how tables look, then, okay, you get the information you need. It's just not a very intuitive experience. So we haven't really met the mark there. You know, perhaps multi-line Braille displays could be useful there. The other thing, staying with spatial things, is indentation, showing indentation in context. We know, for example, that a paragraph needs to start in cell 3. You can see that on a single line display, actually. You can see the two cell indent. You've got cursor routing buttons above the cells. You can count. You know, if you're really not sure whether that indent is 3 spaces or 2 and you can't feel through the cell caps, you can count across the cursor routers. So you can do things for simple things like paragraphs. You can work that out, and that's fairly straightforward. What about, though, if you're programming in, say, Python, where the programming language is dependent upon indents? You can see that there is an indentation there. You can even count how many spaces that indent is, but you can't see the line above or the line below. So you can't see whether or not actually, okay, the line above was an if clause, and that's indented at the same level. So we actually need to indent further because we're now into the if statement. So it's, again, it's really about context. And again, the only way to really do that is to pan up and down and to keep one finger on the braille and see if the braille, you know, is looking good around you. Charts, graphs, images and shapes. A single line display is really good at doing rectangles. You can just do as many 4 signs as you like and you'll get rectangles. That's fine. It can sort of do squares as well. And some people have, you know, like HumanWare, have tried to get it to do circles, and they've got somewhere with it. You know, you're able to do that. But really, I mean, it's not. You can't do it really. You know, trying to show a line graph on a braille display is really quite tricky. HumanWare have tried. It's a really innovative approach, actually, and possibly with a bit more training, people might be able to get used to that. But it's, again, not quite as good. Rectangles and squares are quite useful. You could do bar charts on rectangles and squares, but again, you've got no context of the line, you know, the line above or the line below. And displaying multiple pieces of information simultaneously. On a window, for example, if you're using a computer, you might see the OK button, but you can't necessarily see the text around that OK button. So what are you saying OK to? You can see a combo box. You can see the current choice in that combo box, but you can't see what the other choices are. This happened actually quite a lot when I was booking my flights and I had to choose, you know, am I a United Kingdom citizen or am I something? And I saw United Kingdom citizen and I thought, well, is that actually the one that I want, or is there a better, you know, born in the UK option? It turns out there isn't. But do you know what I mean? You have to move up and down. You can't just see at a glance what all of the options are. You have to look at it one by one and take them in one by one. So screen readers have got over this with something called structured mode in JAWS. I think Supernova calls it logical mode, or it used to call it logical mode, where, again, similar to tables, it takes what it thinks is the most important part of the window and puts that first, and then it puts the next bit next and the next bit next and so on. So you can see, first of all, the OK button, and secondly, what the dialog box text is. But that's, again, you know, you're limited to the amount of information that you can fit on the display. The other thing is when you're reviewing information that has to be in multiple lines, for example, music scores, you might be able to see the right hand of a piano part, but you can't see underneath what the left hand of the piano part is. And even more so for vocal music, you can't see the soprano part, the alto part, the tenor part, and the bass part stacked up on top of each other. You have to pan down. There is a new feature in JAWS called split braille. I think this has a lot of potential. I'm not sure how well it's being realized at the moment. People are liking split braille, but I think there's more that it could do. But there was a really interesting presentation that Freedom Scientific gave about split braille, where they actually showed braille music being shown in split braille. So it had using the buffered mode, you could see the left-hand part on the left-hand part of the display and the right-hand part on the right-hand part of the display. And this is, you know, very interesting. And it's also very interesting because you could use the second region of the braille display to show other things like, you know, you could see you could put the PC cursor in one place and the JAWS cursor in another place. So you could see line numbers on a window, for example, as you moved up and down, because the JAWS cursor, the line number would update. So there's some real potential here with split braille. However, it's only got two regions, and if you were to introduce more regions, each of those individual regions would get smaller and smaller and smaller. So you're losing real estate there. It works best on an 80-cell display, and 80-cell displays are quite long and cumbersome. So that's, I think, set out the need for multi-line braille displays quite well. To what extent do we need the features that single-line displays don't have? Well, I think, you know, we've talked about what they are and we've talked about why we might need them. I suppose the broader question, though, having said all of that, and we can sit there and we can say all of that academically and that's fair enough, I suppose the question still is, well, who cares, really? When I was at school, I would have cared about this. When I was at school, I would have wanted my tables to be set out like tables. I would have wanted my charts and graphs as much as possible. You know, as a musician, I want some of this stuff. But in day-to-day, you know, I actually quite like my single-line braille display. So it would be nice to have a device that fixes some of the problems that are inherent in single-line displays, but just at the moment, I just don't think it's, have a display that can read some tables. Well, that's fine, but I've got used to reading tables the way that I've got used to reading tables. So the one or two occasions a week when I might want to look at a table that needs to be formatted properly, I'll just live with it. I just don't see the importance there. It'd be interesting to see what other people in the room think. And then what compromises are we prepared to make in order to have access to multi-line braille displays? And why don't we just use hard copy? That's been my answer to this ever since I can remember, really. If I actually want a table, you know, and it does happen, you know, if I want to read something spatially and I can't read it spatially because I'm on a single-line braille display, I'll just connect up my braille embosser and I'll emboss the table. Or I'll emboss whatever I need to emboss. You know, I'll emboss the music, I'll emboss it, I'll read it in hard copy. Why not? Why not just carry on doing that? Well, there are a few reasons. There's the price of the hard copy material. There's also, if you are looking at hard copy in terms of transcription, you know, there's the cost of actually paying the transcribers to do it. There's the cost of the time and the skills and all of that sort of thing. There's the size. The size is the big one for me. If I want lots of tables, that's going to involve lots of paper. I've got to store that paper, which is hard work. I've got to, once it's embossed, I've got to collate it, and I've got to store the embossed things, which by the time you punch dots into it, is even more of a pain. You know, the size of the whole book, the size of the individual volumes. This causes problems with storage. It causes problems with postage and all sorts of things. And leading on from that, the environmental impact, which I think is not as bad as we think, because you can recycle braille paper, but in a way you can't recycle print paper, because print paper has ink in it. Nonetheless, we're using a lot of paper, and the dots wear out over time, and it takes a long time to emboss. So we still want multi-line braille displays because of all of the problems. So why are users not buying them? I think there are some interesting arguments as to why users are not buying them. I think some of those arguments are fair enough. I think some of those arguments perhaps are very convenient excuses, and we perhaps ought to do some more research into whether those arguments actually stack up or not. Before I go on, I should also, and I should have done this at the beginning of the presentation, and I apologize for not doing so, I also need to make a distinction between what a multi-line braille display is and what Leona was talking about yesterday with tactile graphics devices, refreshable tactile graphics devices. There is a difference in that you can make a multi-line braille display that produces multi-line braille much more cost-effectively than you can make a tactile graphics device, because you can put the cell spacing further apart and you don't need to worry about having it all joined up. So let's talk about that. People say, I'm not going to buy a multi-line braille display because it's going to cost too much. If we're going to talk about the Monarch, I can see that. The Monarch is probably about 3 to 4, maybe even 5 times the cost, or projected to be, of
a traditional single line display. You can buy a Brailleant for, in the UK, £3,000, a Monarch, well, £15,000 or something. So that's, you know, five times the cost. For sure. Yeah, this is not. Yeah, the cost is real. Let's talk, though, about something like the Orbit Slate or the Canute 360. Canute 360, I've forgotten exactly how much it costs, but somewhere around the £2,500 mark. The Orbit Slate, perhaps slightly more expensive, maybe more at the £3,000 mark. But this is familiar pricing. You know, I'd spend $2,500 to $3,000 on a Brailleant. Some people, and I have one here, would spend sort of $4,000 to $4,500 on a BrailleSense. There was so much excitement about the Optima, and I think there still will be excitement about the Optima when it comes out, and it's going to be more expensive than a Canute or an Orbit Slate. So although price is a factor, and particularly a factor with the graphics displays, I'm not convinced it's the only factor. It's just very convenient. What is perhaps more of a factor, and what I think perhaps people don't think about until they see it, you know, until they have to buy it, is the portability of them. One of the advantages of electronic Braille when it first came out was that it took the bulk away. You had a huge hard copy book that, you know, that you could suddenly fit on an SD card. And you could load that SD card into an electronic device that was possibly slightly bigger than a print book, but not by very much. I've got my BrailleSense in front of me on the lectern, and it's taking up hardly any space. If I had a hard copy book, it would take up more space on the lectern than the BrailleSense would. If I had a Canute on the lectern, it would take up more space than the hard copy would. Admittedly, it would take up less space than 10 or 20 volumes of hard copy, but it would take up more space, I think, than one volume of hard copy. So that's, I think, you know, that is a significant consideration that we really need to think about. Along those lines, we also need to talk about how these machines are powered. Canute 360 does not have a battery, so it might be the cheapest display on the market at the moment in terms of multi-line and in terms of, you know, cost per cell, but it's no good to me because there's no power supply up by this lectern. Well, there might be, but I've got to find it. I'm in the middle of, you know, doing a presentation. I don't want to start my presentation by looking around for a power supply, or I don't want to turn up for a conference and have to. It might be a conference where I need to look at tables. It might be a very important business meeting, but I need to concentrate on the business meeting. I don't need to concentrate on finding a plug socket so that I can figure out how to access those tables. I'm still going to produce hard copy for that meeting if that's what I need to do. Compatibility. Compatibility with mainstream systems. Compatibility with mainstream file formats. You have multi-line Braille displays, not all of them, but some of them, which only support BRF files. So I've still got to go to the trouble of translating this thing. I can't just load a document into it and have it work automatically. You've got some that do have built-in translation, but they only translate plain text files. So I have a Word document with a beautifully formatted table, and I have to convert it to plain text before I put it on my multi-line Braille display, at which point the beautifully formatted table is going to disappear because it's in a text file. So therefore, what's the point of having the multi-line, because I've lost all the formatting anyway? We don't have screen reader support yet, you know, support for online libraries. That's all a bit lackluster as well. And then there's the refresh rate and there's the loudness. People will tell you different stories about refresh rates and loudnesses. Some people, when the Orbit Reader came out, would say it's too loud and it's too slow. Look, it is. It is quite... It's certainly louder than a piezo display, and it's certainly slower than a piezo display. I personally don't find the slowness too much of a problem. Some people would, and that's fine. The loudness is more of a problem. I certainly wouldn't want to be presenting here with an Orbit Reader, because you'd hear the Orbit Reader going through the microphone. I think, though, it's not... it's not as loud as we perhaps make it out to be. A Braille embosser is, I think, louder than even the loudest of multi-line Braille displays. I have on the Braillecast podcast, I left some samples of a Canute refreshing, and it was fairly loud, but an embosser would still be louder. So I wouldn't want to present with a multi-line Braille display, but fine. I think if I was in a meeting and I had to use a multi-line Braille display, I think I could probably get away with it. You know, people are moving around and shuffling and using their pens to write notes and typing on a keyboard and all of that sort of thing. I think my display really would sort of go into the background largely. So what can we do to get around these problems? What are the design considerations? Well, I've talked about portability and I've talked about compatibility and all of that sort of stuff. I think the first thing that we really need to think about is getting that up to speed. I'm presenting on a BrailleSense 6. Part of the reason why I'm presenting on a BrailleSense 6 is because my notes are in Dropbox. If I'm going to pay over the odds, well, not necessarily over the odds, but if I'm going to pay the equivalent price of a BrailleSense 6 for a multi-line Braille display, I want that multi-line Braille display to also be able to access my stuff in Dropbox. You know, I also want it to be able to work, you know, work properly. I want it to have files and folders. I don't want it to just have files. I want it to have folders as well. If I've got 100 folders, I don't want to have to page through, you know, 9 lines. What's that? If I want to get to number 60, that's what? 6 pages, 7 pages to get down to? I don't want to have to page through. I want to just be able to press the first letter and get to it. I want to be able to have onboard file management. I want to be able to find text within a file. I don't just want to go to page, I want to go to text. I want to be able to have access to online libraries. I want to be able to update my firmware over the internet. I've got used to that now. You know, back in the early 2000s, you couldn't update any device over the internet, so it was fine to have to copy it to a memory stick and then put the memory stick in and run an upgrade, or maybe even connect it to a computer and do it that way. We're beyond that now. If I'm paying £4,000 for a Braille device, I want it to update itself. And along those lines, I want it to have a keyboard. I want to be able to, number one, move by, move between files. I want all that first letter navigation stuff, so you need a keyboard for that. I also, if I'm in the middle of reading a table and I find something that I want to fix in that table, I want to be able to fix it. Now, there are ramifications for that. You know, okay, if I'm fixing it, then how am I going to get it back to my sighted colleagues? And there are questions about that. But maybe I'm in a meeting. Maybe we're working interactively with a table. So everybody's got a printout of a table, and we're going through that in a meeting, and everybody's got their pencils, and they're writing pencil notes on their tables. I want to be able to effectively edit the table that's in front of me so that I can do that as well. And not every multi-line Braille display has that. The other big thing I think we need to tackle is this issue of text flow. There are some single-line displays, which, I mean, James was talking yesterday about, you know, HumanWare. It's very interesting that the NLS e-reader from HumanWare can do it, but the HumanWare Braille displays themselves can't do it. You know, you load a BRF file into it, and guess what happens? That your display is 20 cells, your BRF file's 30 cells. You've got long line, short line, long line, short line, long line, short line, you know. And this is on a single line display. If you can't even get it right on a single line display, do you really think we're going to get it right on a multi-line display? Actually, some people have put some real effort into this. Orbit Research, you're able to pan left and right and pan up and down, or put it into a reflow mode where it all just works. But I don't see that happening. I don't think we've really had any sort of innovative thought into, you know, what about the possibility of a table which is 100 characters wide? We've not thought about that at the moment because you've only got paper that's 40 characters wide. But now you're on an electronic Braille display, you could have a table that was 100 characters wide and it could be quite useful, but the Braille display is only, you're only able to pan up and down, you're not able to pan left and right. So I think we need to fix that. And we need to actually work out, I think, what the point of all of these displays are. Going back to what I said initially, okay, a multi-line display is good because it has more than one line. I just don't think that stacks up. We need to be thinking about what problem are we trying to solve. Are we trying to make a machine that is fantastic for reading books? If you're trying to make a machine that's fantastic for reading books, then let it read books. Let's have our EPUB support, you know, let's have our DAISY support, let's have our fantastic navigation. If you're making a device that's good for editing, you know, and for composing multi-line, then let's have some really good composition. And finally, let's talk about the number of lines. Everybody seems to be going for a really high number of lines. Canute's got 9 lines. Monarch's got 10 lines. I'm starting to wonder whether Orbit have got the right idea with having 3 lines. In the market at the moment, there are plenty of 80-cell Braille displays that are 1 line. Why not have an 80-cell Braille display that's 2 lines? It wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't get as much as you would get on a 10-line display, but you would have multi-lines, so you'd be able to see a table and its headers, for example. You'd be able to see, you could possibly have a text and a status line underneath to show information about that text, and it would remain portable. So perhaps we ought to be having a conversation about what do we actually want to see on these multi-line Braille displays, and is there a place for quite a small multi-line Braille display with only 2 or 3 lines? So I've talked about that. I'm nearing the end of the presentation. The final thing I want to talk about is what other people need to do in order to help these manufacturers along. First of all, I want to talk to transcribers about, we prepare material at the moment for hard copy. There are things that we do in order to prepare material for hard copy that actually may not make sense in a soft copy environment. For example, dividing books into volumes. So RNIB is already doing a lot of work in that space, you know, singleizing everything. But let's talk about songbooks. I do a lot of singing at Coventry Cathedral. We have hymn books at Coventry Cathedral, and some hymns have choruses. What tends to happen is that the chorus is written after the first verse in italics and is not written after the subsequent verses. And this is, I mean, this happens in print as well, by the way. This is a space-saving thing, and it works very well because in hard copy, you know, okay, I've got to flick back and I've got to go to this page, and that's fine. But you can't flick back on the same way on a multi-line display. There's possibly some room to rethink some of the transcriber standards to say, if you're transcribing for not even just multi-line, but if you're transcribing for electronic Braille of any sort, ought we to think about, we don't need to save space anymore, we need to make it as presentable as possible. Perhaps we need to have those choruses written after every verse so that people don't have to pan back, because by the time you've got to verse 5 and you're in the middle of singing and you've got to pan back 4 verses to get to the content, to the chorus, that's not something I want to be dealing with. The DAISY Braille file format working group, I'm not going to talk about. I wrote a little bit about it in the paper, but it's been talked about extensively here. But that's going to really help in terms of navigation. Even for Braille displays that don't have a keyboard like the Canute, at least eventually you'll get to a point where there's a go to heading option. And I think that's very valuable. And finally, multi-line Braille display support in screen readers. We need to think about this. And I'm not really seeing much evidence that we're thinking about it. I'm seeing a lot of I mean, perhaps, you know, perhaps because I'm seeing a lot of people say, oh yeah, we're working on multi-line support in NVDA, we're working on multi-line support in JAWS. What does that mean? And I think perhaps we ought to have some focus groups and really sit down and work out what that means. What we don't want is a Braille display that's 9 lines of 40, okay, that's 360 cells in total, so we'll just tell the screen reader that it's a 360-cell display and we'll go with it. We know that that's not going to work. But if we know that that's not what we want, we don't know what we do want. If you're reading a table, you're reading a spreadsheet, for example, do we want to retain the top line of the Braille display to show the column headers? Do we want to be able to freeze a certain number of cells on the left so that we can see the row headers? So you pan right, but only the last 20 cells pan right. The first 20 cells are frozen in place so that you can see the headers. And I feel like there's some real need for discussion to take place, not necessarily from the multi-line Braille point of view, from the Braille display manufacturer's point of view, although they're welcome to be part of it, but also from the screen reader developer's point of view. We need to be talking about what exactly do we want out of this? What does this look like? Perhaps, you know, if you've got 9 lines or 10 lines, do we need to reserve a line for the status bar at the bottom of the screen so you can see what page number you're on? Would it be worth having something where we reserve a line for status messages so you've got 5 lines of text plus, you know, 4 lines of to show other things? So, for example, you could be presenting in a Zoom meeting. You know those really annoying messages. So-and-so has joined the meeting. So-and-so has left the meeting. So-and-so has posted in the chat. Let's have them on the Braille display, but let's have them on line 9. And let's then your fingers know, okay, we can use 8 lines to read, and line 9 has got all the status information on it. But I don't see those conversations happening at a level that users can access and at a level that users can engage with. And I am therefore a little bit skeptical about how well multi-line Braille display support in screen readers is going to come out. And it's what people tell me all the time. You know, why have you not bought a multi-line Braille display? Well, because it's not going to work with my screen reader, and my screen reader is what I want to use it with. Okay, that's valid, but then let's have that conversation and let's make it work with screen readers. So that's really all I've got to say. At present, multi-line Braille displays, I think they have a bit of an identity crisis. They're being marketed as a solution to single-line Braille. Yeah, that we've got multi-line, it's better because it's got more than one line. That's not a purpose. That's just a thing, you know. I feel like because there's no purpose, because we're not saying this is the problem we're trying to solve, it's resulting with functionality that's either very primitive, i.e., yeah, you can read books on it, but they have to be BRF files, or they're too generic to be useful. And this is relegating the status of multi-line displays to secondary status. You have to have a single-line display in order to use your computer. A multi-line display is a bit of a bolt-on. This is a challenge. Users are finding it difficult to justify the cost, not because they're expensive, but because they're an additional. If you could replace your single line with a multi-line, it'd be a lot easier to justify that cost. They're not committing to purchase, they're finding it difficult to do their funding applications and so on. Manufacturers need to rethink their design choices. We need to be designing multi-line Braille displays which solve a specific problem. We need to go after that problem. We need to market that problem. We need to say, this is the problem, and this is how we're trying to solve it. And that way, I think that will make their products more viable. I think it will make their products more useful. And I think more people then would be able to take advantage of them. Thank you very much. Judy Dixon wants to ask a question. Oh, she wants to make a comment. Okay. A roaming mic is coming to you.
I have it. Thank you very much, Matthew. I am quite skeptical about multi-line Braille displays, especially when those lines are 3 inches, 7 or 8 centimeters apart. I mean, how good is that? I think that some years ago, what I think we can only touch one line at a time. And we can take the flat of our hand and run over the whole page and get some sense of the whole page. But I think we need to more creatively use the one line we have on our one-line Braille displays. Some years ago, I saw a prototype at CSUN using a foot pedal. And it was a 4-way joystick foot pedal, but really cleverly designed. So you could go right, left, up, down. And you didn't have to move your hands. You just moved your foot, and it just... It was very slick and very, very cool. And I think that ideas like that need to be pursued so we don't have to pay for multi-line Braille displays. We don't have this giant thing to carry around, but we have more flexibility for the one line that we have.
Jordy Howell, hello.
Hello.
I love the idea of a three-line display because I'm often in a choral context reading a line of words with my right hand and the music with my left at the same time. And so in order to really be efficient, I would love the idea. I'd love to see the orbit slate. I haven't yet. But that idea excites me more than the whole nine lines.
Yeah, I agree. Judy is saying it's huge.
I don't
agree with that. I've seen huger than the orbit slate. The thing is, any display that you're going to come up with is going to be huger than a single line display.
Yeah,
and that's just a reality of that. And that's kind of what I was getting at with the portability angle. You know, it's not going to be as portable as a single line display. Yeah. You will never get an orbit slate in the same form factor as even an Orbit Reader 40 or a Braille Emotion or a Brailliant or something like that.
Yeah,
on that basis, it's huge. And the distances between the lines are quite huge. And it would be really nice if we could bring those line distances down a bit.
Yes.
That has cost implications because of the mechanics involved in actually making it cheap.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But I'm not sure I would quite go as far as to say it's huge. I think it's definitely bigger than what we would like it to be. But I think compared to something like the Monarch or the Canute or something, I think I'd still fit an orbit slate in a bag just about.
Really?
Do you think?
Gosh.
Okay.
Yeah, that's not ideal.
Yeah. Jennifer Dunham. Was that Jennifer Dunham?
Yes.
Yes.
A little gymnastics to get to the mic. I want to thank you for this presentation. I appreciate the ways that you are articulating the fact that these displays are in their infancy. We really have some things to think about, and I appreciate what you've said. I just wanted to highlight some additional reasons why I personally really hope that we can get our multi-line Braille displays into a better state. Because I think, number one, so many students now are being given Braille displays and not hard copy. And I think that there's something lost if you don't have a sense of what the format of a document is like on a regular basis and on a basis that doesn't require you to press a lot of buttons to actively find the information out, if you know what I mean. You can, absolutely. As you said, you can find out the formatting information using a one-line display. I think there's a lot of folks that doesn't come naturally, and they don't do it, and they don't have a sense of it. Secondly, I personally love to move my hands over more than one line. In, for example, poetry. Poetry is another thing where the lines are not broken or done the way they are, just there is a factor in the poetry about those lines. I hope we can get multi-line displays, and I hope we can really focus on these items that you've talked about. Thank you.
Thank you. And it's a good point about the poetry and what some people term a hand scan. Yeah, you're right. And I made the point in the paper. I skimmed over it in the presentation. But yeah, you know, with a sighted person, there is a parity between what they see on their monitor and what they see on their page. There are reasons why they don't like to look at a monitor. There are reasons why they like to print it out. But what they're seeing in front of them is kind of, you know, it's sort of like a page. And we don't get that with a single line display. And that is another thing that, multi-line displays, if they're done well, might be able to help us with.
On Zoom, we have Niels.
Niels Matthijssen on Zoom. Hello.
Good day to everybody. Good evening from South Africa. Yes, it's morning now with you guys. I'm thinking, being a Braille music teacher, and my kids my learners must do SATB. They get a line in the soprano part, and then they must add ATB, alto, tenor, and bass, and sometimes also the numeral figuring, the Roman numeral figuring. So a Braille display with five lines would suit for those kind of things, but I think nine is a little bit too much, and the cost of nine lines is more than five lines. That's something just to look into for Braille music. Because the children cannot remember what they wrote in the elder part, when they're at the base part or at the figuring part, then they got confused, and that's why we still use the normal Perkins Braille machine for that in South Africa.
Mm. I don't disagree with you. Again, the more lines you have, the less portable it becomes. And so I think we need to find a way of improving the not just the distance between the lines, but also the thickness of the display, you know, from bottom to top, the depth, if you like, of the display. I really think we really need to be working on that in order to make it viable. And there's been some really interesting innovation coming out of CSUN about joining displays together. You know, so you have, I can't speak to it because I didn't go to CSUN, but I'm aware of displays where you could start out with, I don't know the dimensions, but you could start out with a two-line display, for example, and then attach another two-line display to it and attach another. And I wonder if that's also a way that we ought to be putting some more attention into in terms of making these displays viable. I think
I'm just thinking, if you use two displays, then they must remember what they wrote on the one display before they can continue on the second display. That's if you're writing only SATB without Roman numbers at the bottom. And I'm not sure if our kids will be able to use those kind of things to use two braille displays as well.
Sorry, I was referring to interlocking displays. So it would become a four-line display, but you could detach the two and then make it two-line displays if you needed to for some other purpose.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, thank you.
We are at time, so I'm going to draw it to a close there. But thank you, everybody, for your attention, and very happy to talk further offline if people would like to.
Thank you, Matthew. Okay, time for coffee break. Thank you.